Hello and welcome to Employment Talk. We're here to discuss the HR issues affecting you and to keep you up to date with the latest employment law news. My name's Jo Mosley. I'm a support lawyer in the employment team at Irwin Mitchell. I write our blogs and newsletters and I keep the team and our clients up to date with what's happening in the world of employment law.
And my name's Elaine Hutley. I'm the national head of our wonderful employment team, working with clients to help them navigate the ever more complex arena of employment law.
And getting more and more complex day by day. How are you, Elaine?
I'm good, thanks, Jo. Really busy now that we're starting to know a little more about the roadmap for the Employment Rights Bill. But personally, I'm also preparing for the start of the school summer holidays.
Goodness, I don't have to do that anymore. It's such a juggle, isn't it?
It is. It's a fun time. My definition of fun is very different to my children's.
I bet.
But anyway, what are we going to be discussing today, Jo?
I thought we could look at two things today. So earlier this week, the government published a list of amendments to the Employment Rights Bill. So some of these are significant, and I'd like to signpost those and explain where we are in terms of the progress of the bill and when the various bits are likely to come into force. I then thought that we could focus on a new change that's been added to the bill, or certainly proposed, which is the ban on so-called NDAs in respect of harassment and discrimination at work.
Tell you what, Jo, the progress of this bill reminds me a little bit of the way the government announced changes to the employment protections during COVID, where everything used to drop on a Friday evening after everyone had logged off for the week. Now, it's not quite as bad as that, but there are a lot of changes being announced at what is a really late stage in the bill. And some of these weren't expected, were they?
No, they weren't. They weren't. And I know what you mean about COVID, but I suppose the difference between now and COVID times, as we call them, was that no one had anything else to do anyway. So it wasn't as if you had anything interesting to do on a Friday night other than, you know, catch up on whatever thing you were watching on Netflix. But anyway, in terms of the late stage, though, I think that's because this is a huge bill. And frankly, it was rushed to meet the government's self-imposed commitment to issue it within the first 100 days, isn't it, in office, not 10. That would be even more dramatic. And it didn't give itself time to think through all of the potential consequences of making all the changes that it wanted to. And of course, that's led to it having to make amendments now.
I think that's right. But it's not the best way to legislate. But I suppose it is better to recognise that some things just won't work now and to sort those out before the bill becomes law.
Yeah, I agree, but I'm not quite so optimistic. There's still so much in the bill that's less than ideal. And I don't doubt that many of the proposals were well-intentioned, but there's just not enough thought being given to how those laws are going to work in practice. But rather than me drone on and moan, that's for another time. Let's start by looking at what changes have been tabled then.
Okay, but before we do that, shall I explain to our listeners where we are with the bill and what happens next?
Yes, please. Go on then.
Okay, so the bill is still going through the Lords. The report stage is due to start on the 14th of July. And once that's done...
So that's Monday, isn't it? That's Monday.
It is. Yes. So actually, by the time we release this, it might have happened for our listeners. So once that's done, it goes back for a third reading before it enters into the final stages. Now, there isn't enough time left to get all that done before the summer recess. So we won't see the final version of the bill until September or possibly October.
Yeah. Probably we should also mention that the government has published a roadmap which explains when the various changes are going to come into force. And I think it's true to say that many of these are being pushed back later than we initially thought. So, for example, the third party harassment provisions, which you and I discussed last month and predicted would come into force later this year or early next, turns out we were way off the mark on that. The roadmap actually says that that aspect won't come into force until the autumn of 2026, even though the government doesn't need to pass any other regulations or consult on it.
That's right. Our crystal ball failed us a little bit.
Didn't it?
But the other big one is day one unfair dismissal rights. And the government said that that wouldn't come into force before autumn 2026. And in fact, it's now saying it will be 2027 for that one.
Well, I suppose that's not before autumn 2026. But even so, I think we did have that year in mind. Anyway, we've published a blog which explains what's coming in and when and covers all of the new changes. So if you've signed up to receive our blogs and newsletters, you should already have received that. But if you don't and would like a copy, please just get in touch with either Elaine or I. Okay, then. So let's get back to the amendments that have been tabled. Now, I should just point out that table just means proposed and that not all of those aspects that have been tabled will actually go ahead. So I suggest, Elaine, that we only focus on those that have been made by Labour, as those are the ones that are likely to get the green light. So can you briefly describe what those cover, please?
Yeah, sure. And this is just an overview. We are going to look in at the detail of these in future podcasts once the bill has passed. Now, first, there's a major change proposed to the original plan to ban fire and rehire practices. Now, our listeners might remember that the bill made it automatically unfair to dismiss someone for refusing to agree to a variation in their terms and conditions unless the business was about to go under. And it didn't matter what changes the employer wanted to make. The new proposed wordings will give employers a bit more wriggle room. You still won't be able to make any changes to pay, hours or holiday, but you will be able to make other changes, for example, requiring an employee to work at a different location, provided the employer follows a reasonable process and that factors relating to that are specified. It is a lot more complicated than that, but that's just the gist.
Yeah, yeah. So basically, this change, I think, is going to put sort of routine contractual tweaks, if you like, back into the conventional unfair dismissal regime.
Yeah, that's right. So employers will need to consult and will need to offer an incentive to accept the new terms, but it will allow employers to argue that what they did was fair.
Okay. So are there any others? Well, I know there are. So my question really is, what are the others?
Yes, there are, Jo. No, so there's a ban on NDAs, which we're going to come on to shortly. And the government has also said that it's going to introduce a new right for bereavement leave to include pregnancy loss before 24 weeks. Others that our listeners might have seen include major changes to whistleblowing laws and changes to the hellishly complicated 0 hours guaranteed hours proposals. But those last two haven't been proposed by Labour, and so they're not going to go ahead until Labour supports them.
Until I suppose it's really unless, isn't it? So let's park those until we know what the Labour Party are going to do with regard to those. And let's move on then to the NDAs. So do you mind starting by explaining what an NDA is? Because it's a term that's bandied about a lot in the media, but it isn't really used in an employment context, is it? And by that, I mean the words themselves. We don't normally refer to a non-disclosure agreement.
No, that's right. So an NDA just stands for a non-disclosure agreement. And as you've said, we don't usually see those as standalone NDAs in the employment context, but it is common for confidentiality provisions to be included in, for example, settlement agreements. And an employee might also have similar provisions in their contract of employment.
Yeah. So could you perhaps give an example of the sort of wording that's used in a settlement agreement?
Yeah, sure. So it's quite common for employees to agree to keep confidential the fact that they've entered into a settlement agreement, what's in it, and the circumstances leading up to signing it, which basically means that they can't tell anyone outside a few accepted people what happened and how much they've received.
Yeah, it's probably worth explaining what those exceptions are, Elaine. Who exactly can an employee normally tell or talk about the agreement with?
Yeah, so if you've signed a settlement agreement, the settlement agreement usually permits you to tell your partner or immediate family what's happened. You can still blow the whistle. You can talk about what's happened if there's a criminal investigation and the police ask you questions, or if you're asked to give evidence at court. You can also tell your doctor or other professionals you want advice from. Most people you tell must also keep what they have learned from you confidential. Now, there are a few other categories, but those are probably the main ones.
Okay. What about prospective employers, though? What can you tell them if you've agreed to a confidentiality clause in a settlement agreement?
You'll usually agree what you can say as part of the settlement agreement itself, but then you won't be able to expand on it.
That's interesting, actually, because that's one of the criticisms about NDAs. And you might remember that back in, I think it was either 2018 or 2019, the Women and Equalities Committee looked into NDAs and they made a number of recommendations to the government. And basically, they saw them as a bad thing and they wanted the government to legislate to get rid of them. And during that process, they heard evidence from a number of people who'd signed NDAs. And the impression they got was that not being able to tell a prospective employer why you've left your job was a real problem. And to prepare for this, I had a quick look at the report yesterday, and the committee was really concerned that the lack of clarity about what employees could and couldn't say had, and I'm quoting here, a devastating effect on their careers, self-esteem and personal life. So that's certainly where, you know, what they thought. Okay, so let's move on now then and talk about what changes we think the government is going to make to NDAs. Is it true to say that they're going to ban them altogether?
No, it's only looking to ban them when there are allegations of discrimination or harassment.
So, you know what my next question is? Does that include every type of discrimination or harassment?
Almost. So it relates to most types of discrimination as set out in the Equality Act. So direct discrimination, indirect discrimination, discrimination arising from disability, etc. But what isn't covered is the duty to make reasonable adjustments or victimisation. And I'm not sure why those have been omitted, but we might find out in due course. In terms of harassment, it covers all types of harassment set out in the Equality Act, but not harassment under the Protection from Harassment Act, nor does it cover bullying unless it's related to a protected characteristic and so would be actionable under the Equality Act.
So a type of harassment, in other words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So what does it say about NDAs that relate to discrimination or harassment then?
So it says that any provision in an agreement is void insofar as it purports to prevent a worker from alleging that someone has harassed or discriminated against them or from disclosing how their employer dealt with that investigation.
Yeah. Okay. So in other words, even though you may have signed the agreement, if it contains these sorts of restrictions, you aren't bound by them.
Yeah. So you can sign the agreement, you can receive monies and still disclose what's happened to you or what you say has happened to you. And your employer won't be able to sue you and try and get the money back because the agreement won't be enforceable.
So does that mean then, do you think, that the whole agreement will be unenforceable? What about, for example, if the employee has settled other claims? So they've got discrimination claims alongside, for example, unfair dismissal or holiday pay.
I don't think the whole agreement will be void. The draft wording refers to any provision in an agreement will be void. So it's the provision that's struck out, not the whole agreement. Employers will be able to keep certain bits confidential, but they'll need to make sure the contracts are carefully worded.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so can I just ask you then to go back to what you said about not being able to prevent an employee disclosing how the employer dealt with their allegation? So the draft wording says responded to, and that isn't defined as far as I could see. But I'd have thought that it would cover the investigation, if any took place, and what happened as a result of that investigation. For example, was anyone sacked? Is it really that wide? And would it also cover how much the employer paid you to compensate you for what had happened?
Yeah, as it's currently drafted, it could be that wide. So putting in place a settlement agreement is part of an employer's response, as is the amount that they're paying you.
Might it also allow the employee to refer to individuals? So let me give you a hypothetical example. Let's say I accuse my line manager of harassing me and Erwin Mitchell investigate, and having done so, they uphold my complaint. Could I name that manager?
Again, as it's currently drafted, yes, I think you could. The draft wording refers to relevant harassment or discrimination, and what's relevant includes the behaviour of the employer and someone that they employ.
I assume that I'd also be able to name the individual in question, even if, in the scenario I've just given you, Owen Mitchell didn't uphold my complaint because the legislation refers to an allegation. So there's no need to prove anything happened.
Yeah, that's right. It covers both the allegations and how an employer responds to those allegations. An allegation isn't defined, so it could even apply to allegations that the employee doesn't believe to be true.
Crikey. Mm-hmm. So is there any wriggle room then for employers or employees who want the terms upon which they've agreed a settlement to be kept confidential once this comes into force?
That's a really interesting question, because the draft legislation includes the right for the government to exclude some agreements from this ban, but we don't really know what it has in mind. Plus, the bit that deals with that then goes on to say that even if the agreement is excluded from the ban, the government could still decide to make the NDA bit void in some circumstances.
Hold on. So going to be some exceptions to this, but even then they might still be caught.
It's a bit odd, isn't it? Yeah, I can only assume that you won't be able to include blanket bans, but we're going to have to wait and see.
Yeah, I did a bit of digging around to see if I could find out what the government might have in mind, and I came across some legislation that was introduced in Ireland last year, and they also banned NDAs, and they were broadly banning them along the same lines as this proposal. I think it was slightly wider than that, but basically you were talking about harassment and discrimination. But they have expressly excluded some agreements from the ban. So agreements reached via an official mediation scheme are excluded, but so are agreements where the employee has asked for confidentiality. Now, for that bit to kick in, the employee must have initiated the discussion. It can't have been initiated by the employer. And they must also have obtained independent legal advice, which has to be in writing, and that advice has to be paid for by the employer. But even where the employee has asked for confidentiality, so they've entered into an agreement on that basis and they've been paid compensation, they still have a 14-day cooling off period, which means that they can say, I've changed my mind, and then talk about what has happened to them. What do you reckon?
I'm not sure about the cooling off period, but otherwise that sort of arrangement does seem sensible to me. In my experience, lots of people who reach settlement with their employer want what has happened to them to remain confidential. They may worry that other employers might see them as a troublemaker, or that there's no smoke without fire. And it's not often that we see employees saying that they'll only sign an agreement if the confidentiality clauses are removed. They may want them tweaked. And if that's what they're asking for, and if it's reasonable, most employers will consider and or agree to their request. Right. So I do hope that the government looks at this in the round, because it really isn't the case that all NDAs are bad. They are not routinely put in place to cover up widespread misconduct of the sort that, you know, we saw Harvey Weinstein was responsible for. And as I've already said, you can't prevent someone who's signed an agreement from going to the police if they've been sexually assaulted, for example.
I suppose that even if the government doesn't include these carve-outs, though, someone who doesn't want their situation to become known about by other people simply won't tell anybody, and their employer is unlikely to say anything either.
Yeah, sure. But what about if things change? For example, say a junior alleges that her supervisor has harassed her. She leaves and agrees to sign a settlement agreement in exchange for compensation. She's got no intention of telling anyone. But then 6 months later, a colleague or previous colleague says that the same manager is harassing her. In those circumstances, she may then want to share her story.
Yeah. And I think that was the sort of scenario the Women and Equalities Committee was concerned about back in 2019. And they were worried about people entering into NDAs as a way of covering up problems, you know, serious underlying problems that were going on in some of these organisations.
Yeah. And I guess we're going to have to see what the regulations that will sit behind this will say.
Yeah. But that's, of course, not the only piece of heavy lifting being left to regulations, is it?
No. The regulations may also widen the scope of protection beyond workers. So, for example, it might include people who are doing work experience or training or have a different sort of contractual arrangement in place.
Yeah. So to finish then, Elaine, can I ask you to comment whether on balance you think banning NDAs is a good or bad thing? And I know that's a bit simplistic and we don't normally do simplistic and I'm not going to hold you to what you say now, but I'm interested in what you think about that, because there's a lot of employment lawyers that I follow that think it's a really bad idea and might actually make it much harder for victims to obtain redress.
Well, I think most good lawyers will always consider the option of a settlement and discuss this with their client. And this is the case whichever party you're acting for. For the business, there's commercial considerations to factor in, particularly the time and cost of defending claims and the effect that this has at an organisational level, but also the impact that it has on the individuals who are involved in the witness, in the litigation, for example, witnesses.
So managers, people like that.
Yeah, who aren't used to this forum, and it's an alien kind of process for them to go through. And for claimants, it can also be incredibly stressful because it's personal to them. We sometimes think it's a bit like a roller coaster. And on top of the stress that it causes them personally, they're also going to likely to incur costs. So, yeah. And for both sides, it's really worth remembering that litigation, it's an adversarial process and the outcome isn't ever certain. Even if you think you've got the best possible case, you might be surprised by the outcome which is reached. And that's when the outcome is reached. You know, trials can take months and the process leading up to the trial can take years sometimes. And people have their lives put on hold for a very long time that can make it much harder for them to, and I hate this expression, but you know what I mean, move on. Mm. So on the one hand, I understand that some of the headlines we've seen about the way that NDAs have been used are incredibly distasteful, and they've effectively been misused, which I don't think anybody would ever support the use of them in that way. However, yeah, in all my years of practice, I've not seen them used in that way. What I see most commonly is them being used appropriately. And by that, I mean the parties say, let's agree to disagree and we'll both move on. And it's a clean break principle. And so I guess I'm a little bit cautious and I'm interested to see the detail. And I'm interested to see and maybe a little bit nervous about whether the right balance is struck to say NDAs can be helpful to achieve settlement and for the parties to move on, but they have to be used in the right way. And I wouldn't want these provisions to come in a way that is potentially counterproductive to settlement being reached, especially if actually a settlement is in the best interest of both parties in that potential litigation. So I'm a wait and see, I think.
Okay, given what you've said then, I guess you'd be surprised then by the jubilation that's been expressed by campaigners.
Yes and no. I mean, the women that have campaigned for it really objected to the idea that women's silence was being bought. And this was in the context of the Harvey Weinstein and the hashtag MeToo movement. Yeah. And as I've said, I don't think anybody would argue against that. But as I say, in my experience, that's not how NDAs are commonly used. And not everybody who signs an agreement feels that way. As I've said, some individuals who sign up to settlement agreements just want to put what has happened to them behind them and get on with their lives. And that's likely to be more difficult if this goes ahead in its current form.
Let's hope then that the government does carve out some exceptions so that those people who do want to settle their claims in exchange for a reasonable confidentiality provisions can do so.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Okay, anything else you want to say before we finish then, Elaine?
Just that if you've not signed up to receive our invitations and newsletters, please get in touch. And the same goes for anyone who'd like to suggest topics for Joe and me to discuss. You can reach us via LinkedIn or the owenmitchell.com website.
Fabulous. Thank you very much. And that's it for today. Please tune in next month if you want to hear more about the latest employment law updates alongside expert commentary. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.